everybody. I'm Dan Juergen, Vice Chairman of IHS Market, and I want to welcome you to CERAWeek Conversations presented by IHS Market. We're very pleased today to be talking with Mike Wirth, who's the Chairman and CEO of Chevron. And Mike, welcome to CERAWeek Conversations.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to join you virtually from my desk at home.
Right. It's all of our home studios. Mike, I thought we might start when we were talking before. You mentioned you were in Singapore when the SARS outbreak occurred, and wanted to ask you just what you learned from that and took away from that.
Yeah, so I did. I lived in Singapore it's almost 20 years ago now when SARS broke out, and Singapore, Hong Kong, and China were most heavily impacted by that. And, relatively small scale in the scheme of what we're experiencing now with COVID-19. But at the time, really impactful, particularly in those communities. I recall how quickly people modified their behavior. And the fear of the unknown was palpable. And people didn't know how it was being passed within the community, didn't know who they could trust. And there was a period of time there where the uncertainty was very high. And of course, SARS had a high fatality rate. And so anybody who caught SARS, there was a real concern about whether they would survive. Singapore, very advanced country, managed to get their arms around it pretty quickly with both medical technology, contact tracing, and technology-enabled tracing, but the kind of the emotional residue was with us for quite a long time. And even after the health scare had been kind of brought under control, people didn't forget it easily. And I don't think they did make changes in some of their behavior. And it was only a very gradual process where we saw people come back. And these were, whether it was employees of our company or friends and family. We had small children in school at the time. It was on everybody's mind for much longer than the actual, in hindsight, the actual health risk was high. And we certainly, as a company, used that experience to begin our pandemic response plan.
You may be the only company I know of, at least that I know of, that actually had a pandemic response plan. Can you just say a little bit about that and how you developed it?
Yeah, well, certainly many companies have business continuity plans and emergency response plans for unforeseen developments that could impact their business. We have a very specifically drawn pandemic response plan that was created in the aftermath of SARS, and then we had various avian and swine flu cases, MERS, Ebola, Zika. We've continually refreshed it as we face these threats. And of course, we operate around the world like so many companies in our industry do, that something like Zika or MERS or Ebola could feel far away to people in the United States, but it's very present for a company that operates in the regions of the world where these viruses have broken out and have created real concern. So we have a very structured pandemic response plan that has been continually upgraded. We activated it in January. So this is before it was much of a concern even in Europe, and certainly not in North America, but we're in China and we're watching the data carefully, and stood up our corporate pandemic response team. And very quickly, we had 50 some odd regional and local pandemic response teams set up around the world, reflecting our operating footprint, to try to get ahead of this, to begin to stand up some of the preventive measures and safeguards, start to think about hygiene, distancing, cleaning, prepare for alternate shift schedules, different types of work modes. And so we've been, I think, well prepared for this. Obviously, you continue to adjust to new information as it emerges and as we learn more. But we did have a plan, and I think there's value in having a plan and a place to start.
And how is it affecting your operations now, the virus, in terms of what has gone smoothly? What have been the challenges?
Yeah, so I'll start with our operations, where the real heroes are, the people that show up every day to keep energy flowing into the economy. which supports the goods and services that we all rely on and certainly supports the pandemic response effort. It's hard because we have to really be conscious of the risks in a work environment. So everything from shift scheduling to, you know, hygiene and distancing standards exist throughout our operations. We've been largely unaffected in terms of direct impact from the health crisis. We've got 150 cases now in our employees and contractor workforce, more so contractors than employees. And concentrated in a few areas, Kazakhstan being the one that's had the most significant numbers, although mostly asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic cases. I think the biggest challenge, Dan, for us, and I think this is true for others in our industry that have workforces that rotate to locations in remote and distant geographies, the travel restrictions that governments have imposed make it very difficult to bring people to work or away from work. And so we're working very carefully to try to be sure that we're doing all we can to enable that so people get the rest that they need and get away from work. But that's probably the biggest single challenge is moving people around the world into some of the locations where that's our mode of operation.
I guess Tengiz right now, I suppose, is your biggest capital project and yes, where you have the most people on site. And I think you've talked about how you've had to change the schedules.
Yeah, we've had north of 25,000 people on site there when this began. We're progressing a large project to expand the production capacity of Tengiz to about 1 million barrels a day. Project slated to come on 24 months from now. And we're bringing modules in from Korea. And certainly South Korea saw this early on and has managed it quite well. We're down to the last half dozen or so modules that will ship out this quarter. But on site, we have people that live in about 100 different camps and different trades and crafts that are required for construction on site and different nationalities. They come from many different countries. We've had an outbreak within some of the camps, the contractor camps, and have isolated workers and have begun to actually demobilize non-critical path activity. So we're able to maintain work on the core critical path construction, and that will require several thousand workers, but they're on the order of 15,000 to 20,000 workers that we will demobilize, and we're in the process, we've largely accomplished that now, and then bring them back here a few months into the future as we feel like we understand the health risks better. And as that work begins to come back onto the critical path, the plan would be to remobilize with even stronger and more robust protections in place. Testing is getting better all the time now, the access to testing technology and capability. And so a very thoughtful effort to demobilize and working closely with the authorities there. To do it in a way that is safe.
Right. So overall around the world, obviously people need to go in and work refineries, they need to be on platforms, but a lot of your people now are working remotely. And how's the communication been?
Yeah, so about a quarter of our workforce are out on operating facilities, ships, rigs, refineries, plants, and about three quarters work in some sort of an office environment from small ones to large ones. By and large, we've transitioned to working from home or from alternate locations for almost all of that workforce. And it has been, I think, smoother than most people would have guessed if you would have said, we're going to do this and we do it in a very short time period. We closed the books on a quarter for the first time ever with everybody working remotely around the world. We have managed to continue, core functions of the business with a workforce that's working remotely. You know, a lot of our people are set up to travel, to work from home, and so they have the basic technology, and we've been investing in the infrastructure to enable remote work for years. We're really, I think, climbing the capability curve more rapidly than we would have in normal times.
Well, one thing with, of course, the oil industry, the global oil and gas industry has continued to deliver and has shown, I think, resilience that, some people might have doubted beforehand.
Everybody has a different definition of what's essential. And I actually worked, I chaired a business roundtable task force to try to get the states and the U.S. to agree on a common set of definitions, because I learned from, you know, my counterparts at companies like 3M and Johnson and Procter & Gamble that their supply chains for everything from hand sanitizer to PPE rely on small and mid-sized suppliers who are being shut down by well-intentioned local officials. Energy has been pretty clearly deemed essential because the supply chains that support everyday life and especially support the health and medical industry require energy to function. So our workers have been deemed essential by governments around the world, but they still work under these very demanding circumstances with a lot of uncertainty. And I think the industry has a lot to be very proud of, that we've been able to continue to meet those needs, even as demand has come off and markets now are pretty well supplied. But if you didn't have the essential products and services that enable the response, the situation would be even worse. And so I think our industry, as it always does during times of crisis, be they natural disasters, conflicts, different unforeseen events, the men and women of our industry step up and perform in a way that should make everything work.
One thing that people hadn't thought about, you know, not so long ago, people were criticizing plastics and everything like that. And now, I mean, what is PPE? It's mostly plastics. It wouldn't exist without the petrochemical industry.
Gloves, gowns, masks, face shields. And if you go into an emergency room, an intensive care unit, or a hospital, the medical supplies and medical equipment are manufactured from materials derived from petrochemical products. They're packaged in them. They're kept sanitary and sterile by these products. And so, our industry is ubiquitous and essential, and particularly in terms of the things that are absolutely necessary for health professionals to respond to this.
Yeah. Whether it's either, as you say, an emergency room, or even, you know, people are discovering there is an advantage of plastic bags over reused cloth bags in terms of safety and health. But I think it's not a message that's well recognized, I think. Do you feel people make the connection between what you do?
No, right now people are I think, focused on the first order issues that they're facing, right? Are they safe? Is their family safe? How do they change their behavior to try to ensure people stay safe? And then the next order, which is, do I have a job? How are my finances? And so I think these other issues, as a matter of kind of interest or policy, are lower down the list for the average person. People that are close to the industries are aware of them, but I think the average person is not.
You did say that, obviously, as you noted, we're in an area in which demand has collapsed in a way that probably had never been anticipated. The severity of the downturn, how's it affected you all? How are you adjusting?
Well, I think like everybody, we've seen demand for finished products collapse with the policies to restrict economic activity around the world. Certainly, jet fuel has been the most heavily impacted, and you've seen that the aviation industry is under extreme pressure right now. Gasoline, probably next in terms of impact, down plus or minus 50%, sometimes more than that, as these lockdowns have gone into place. Diesel fuel a little bit less because it's agriculture and transport of goods and services are still required. And so we were already in a market that was pretty well supplied, and we had OPEC with production cuts in place through the last few years for the most part, and I think the margin and price environment has reflected a pretty well supplied market. As the demand dropped off dramatically, and then of course we had the breakdown in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Russia at the OPEC meeting. It's created a market that's tremendously oversupplied, and demand has dropped at a rate and in a magnitude we've never really seen in modern times.
I was thinking that it used to be that $30 a barrel would be the worst case scenario. Now $30 a barrel is, in a sense, a almost a welcome scenario, given where the market has been.
Amazing how quickly we normalize our expectations. Yeah, when we've been down in single digits and in the teens, $30 seems like at least a waypoint on the journey back to what you would consider to be a more normal balance in the market and prices that incent the right kinds of investments in development.
The other day in your earnings call, you said that kind of everybody, more or less, everybody knows what the playbook it is, but the question is execution of the playbook, and I thought maybe you could elaborate on that.
Sure. You know, we're a commodity business, and as you've chronicled, you know, in your writings over the years, the cycles of the industry are well known. And, you know, the market is never truly in balance. It's always in transition from length to shortage, and demand and supply are constantly moving. You've got storage and inventory that help work through the imbalances as they occur. And the market signals tend to incent consumption or conservation, investment or slowing down of investment, but there are cycles. It's a commodity business and it's prone to cycles, and it's a capital intensive business, which means you know, your balance sheet really matters. And so certainly, you know, having grown up in the downstream side of the business where margins are tough and generally, you know, you prepare for them to be tougher next year than they are this year. I've tried to position our company to compete and be successful no matter what the environment, and that means to be prepared for a downturn. We've been in a long economic expansion, and I think most people expected some sort of a recession here in the upcoming period of time. Nobody expected it to be as deep or as dramatic as what we're experiencing now. We had the company prepared with a strong balance sheet, low levels of debt, a flexible capital budget, which we've intentionally reshaped from one that a decade ago was heavily dependent on long cycle, very expensive projects where you have little flexibility once you've sanctioned the project, to one now that is dominated by shorter cycle projects where we do have flexibility, and then a low break-even price. And so we've been trying to take our cost structure down, invest in assets that have a lower cost of supply, so that we could be prepared for a down cycle and to be strong enough to withstand even a prolonged period of time of tough market conditions. And I just, you know, I have a fundamental kind of a belief that I've grown up with that's the prudent way to run a commodity company in markets that are uncertain and prone to cycles. And so, look, everybody's feeling pain right now, and we're certainly in that category. I feel like we had positioned ourselves to be ready for this and to ride through this, but it'll be tough. Everybody's going to have to make adjustments. We have others are doing the same thing.
You, I mean, I think you always had a large acreage position in the Permian, but was the focus of turning to the Permian a deliberate effort to build flexibility and short cycle into the business?
Well, it was, because the Permian is highly economic, and economic even at lower prices. And we do have a substantial acreage position. They're mostly fee acreage, so we don't have drilling obligations. We don't have royalty obligations on it. And so the manner in which you hold the land makes it even more attractive. But on the kind of first order economics, it's an attractive investment. And then the flexibility of it is something that we've absolutely, you know, been conscious in building that into our capital plans, and so it works at multiple levels. We didn't intend to, you know, we'd like to run it ratably. You can really improve execution when you have this factory kind of operation and you keep repeating and improving and pushing to use technology and techniques and learnings to get even better. And we're certainly on that path. So the intent wasn't to bring levels down unless we had to, but we wanted to have the ability to do that in the event we needed to. And it's, you know, I think it served us well as we've gone into this period.
Well, that's right. So as you've cut back now, first, I think you make a distinction between curtailments and shut-ins, right? Because we have, in a new paper we've done, about 17 million barrels a day of shut-in from OPEC, non-OPEC, plus what companies are doing. in your mind, what's the distinction between curtailments and shutting in?
Yeah, so right now we're shutting in some of the OPEC or OPEC plus countries as a result of government actions, and then in primarily North America due to economics and logistics. Broadly speaking, I would say more of what we're doing is curtailing than actually shutting in, and you can, restrict flowing from your wells without actually shutting them down completely. And of course, each reservoir is different, wells are different, the technical issues, the logistics and financial issues, economic issues can vary. But broadly speaking, we've taken some complete shutdowns. But in general, if you can keep production flowing, you can mitigate some of the risks of a hard shutdown and a restart, which can be solved with people and money and technology usually.
Even with the Permian, you're able to curtail rather than shutting in the wells altogether.
Yeah, and it varies. There are some areas where we may do a shut-in of an area completely, which allows us to take some costs, which in the short term might be variable, but in the medium term, or in the short term may feel like it's fixed, but in the medium term it can be variable to the extent you can shut down an area of operations, the infrastructure that goes along with that. And so there will be some areas where we may take in full shutdowns, but more of that would be curtailing production to limit some of the economic impacts of these things, but also reduce the risk of damage to reservoir or well.
Right. Listening to you, and again, what you were talking about a week or two ago on your earnings call, I have the sense that resources are an asset, technology is an asset, but that you see the balance sheet as an asset too. And I thought maybe ask you to just elaborate on that idea.
Yeah, I really learned this from our now retired chief financial officer, Pat Yerington, who emphasized to me throughout my career that the balance sheet is one of the most important assets the company has. As an engineer, I tend to think of refineries and platforms and oil
fields. Valves.
As our assets. And the message that Pat was making is that the balance sheet is an asset that you will have to rely on at some point. And if your balance sheet has been weakened, like any other asset, if it hasn't been maintained and taken care of, invested in, it can't perform the way you may need it to perform. And on the other hand, if you tend to your balance sheet the way you should tend to every other asset in your portfolio, when the day comes that you really need to lean on it, your balance sheet will be strong, it will be healthy, and you'll have the ability to get performance out of that asset when some of your other assets are under stress because they can't perform, largely because of things outside of our control. And so I think it has led us to have a kind of a conservative view on financial matters, but certainly one that, again, to my earlier comments on commodity business, you do need to be prepared for these cycles.
Right. Well, where we are in the cycle now, does it look to you that we're storage is pretty full or very full?
I would say it's fully spoken for, if not fully utilized. Right. It's pretty hard to get your hands on storage right now, be it onshore or floating. It's pretty well committed. And of course, those who hold the storage, they've got some options. They can use it. They can make it available to others. They can hold it for the future, depending upon their view of the market. But access to storage is pretty tough right now.
If we look to another part of your business, which is LNG, how does that look now?
Yeah. So LNG markets had already been really characterized by a surge of supply that we've seen over recent years, and steady demand growth. Certainly a couple of years ago, China showed some real strong demand growth, which has flattened out a little bit now. But LNG markets had been cyclically a little long on supply, and demand kind of grows steadily where supply comes in these big tranches. And so we'd already seen LNG prices reflecting that. This current circumstance doesn't help as economies have slowed down and demand for LNG reflects that as well. And so you're seeing cargoes out of the U.S. that are not flowing that people expected to flow. Prices are reflecting spot prices. Our company sells most of our LNG on long-term contracts that are tied to oil pricing. And so to this point, and these contracts tend to be lagged, you know, 60, 90 days, sometimes a little bit more than that even. And so our LNG sales have actually reflected oil prices back when they were at higher levels than they are now. We're beginning to see these lower oil prices will roll into our contract pricing, which will bring oil link prices down closer to where LNG spot prices have been here over these next period of time.
And it clearly, a lot depends on the timing of recovery.
Everything depends on timing of recovery. I mean, you know, a lot of interest in OPEC actions, a lot of interest in curtailments or cuts out of producers. But the real question is when and how does demand return? And certainly, it would appear that the market has found a bottom. Most of the data you look at from anywhere in the world would suggest we're not seeing demand erode even further right now. And in some places, we're beginning to see signs that demand is coming back a little bit, but it's still well off of where it was prior to the.
You are seeing some signs. I mean, when we look at gasoline stations, I mean, the data we have shows that it's coming back a little bit, gasoline demand.
Yeah, it is. Certainly in the U.S., we've seen it even in some states that have been locked down pretty hard. Weekly gasoline sales have been inching up. Some of the other countries that are through this a little bit further, or at least through the first wave, we've seen a stronger recovery in that. Air travel, not so much yet. That still is a pretty tough market. But it doesn't look like things are getting worse, and they're gradually getting better now. I think the real question is there a second wave of the virus? Do we see some of these policies restrain activity again, or are we on a gradual resumption of economic activity pointed back towards something that looks like it did prior to the crisis?
And at this point, there's no answer. I mean, events will determine that. Well, let me just ask you one or two more questions in this conversation. You've observed that there's a lot of disparity, maybe more than there's ever been or for a long time among the major companies. And maybe just ask you how you see what you mean by the different strategies and the different approaches.
Yeah, I think you're right. And if I go back 10 years ago or so, and I remember being with our executive team, and we had the visions and strategies of all the major competitors on a whiteboard, but they didn't have logos. And the idea was to, try to match the company with the strategy. And some people couldn't even identify our own strategy.
Embarrassing moment.
but there was a period of time when the strategies across the industry looked very much alike. And I don't think we see that anymore. I think we've seen some very distinct choices being made by different companies in positioning. And whether it's upstream, downstream weighting, oil and gas weighting, conventional energy versus energy transition weighting, there are a series of choices that companies have made and trajectories they've begun to put their companies on that don't all follow along the same path the way they once did. And I think that creates some very interesting choices for investors as they look at what kind of exposure they want. I think it creates interesting choices for the companies as we look to recruit talent and compete, invest in technology, have access to markets. Because some people are, doubling down on certain things, and others are kind of stepping back from other things. And so I think the choices being made for investment in hard assets, in technology, and in capability are really beginning to spread apart more than we've seen really during my career.
Well, is it, as we know that the world is accelerated digitalization. Is it too soon to say whether you all have started thinking about what kind of world you'll be working in and planning for when this is over, whenever it's over?
No, we're having those discussions. As we talked about earlier, people are working differently than they had before. We were already, like so many others, embarking upon a digital journey to begin to take, you know, decades of legacy technology platforms and take advantage of the cloud, of mobility, of artificial intelligence, and some of the things you can do with big data now. I think this only accelerates that journey as we really see the value of it, and people become more confident in these technologies. And of course, we've all had to be much more flexible in terms of how we work, how we trust our employees, how they get their work done. And I think there will be a new paradigm, if you want to call it that, on the other side of this. I don't think everybody will always work from home, but I also think that the traditional model where everybody always comes to the same place, where everybody get, you know, people get on planes to go to meetings that they might be able to do using other technologies, I think there will be changes. And I think, you know, every company in every industry will have to sort through those. I think the drivers will be slightly different depending upon the type of business and the geography you cover. But I think this is a bit of a pivot point in many ways. And certainly the way that we work, I believe, is one of those.
So it will be both changes internally in how the company works and then changes in the world that you provide services and fuel to.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very interesting because you can, and of course, as you said earlier, nobody really knows the pace of the recovery. And it's very hard, I think, to be certain as to what structural changes will occur. You can hypothesize that air travel may not come back for a long time. You certainly hear some of the airlines that are worried about this. You hear people talk about the fact that they're commuting may not be the same as it was before. On the other hand, if you look at the data on public transportation and both levels of usage of public transportation and people's attitudes about public transportation, they're very reluctant to get on a bus or a train or even a rideshare, a van pool or an Uber pool kind of a thing, because they're putting themselves in contact with others who they don't know. And so there's some pretty good data coming out of China and other places now that would suggest at least a near-term predisposition for people to move from public transit to private vehicles, which has demand implications as well. And so I think the landscape that will emerge will be different. I think it's very hard to predict it, and I think it will be different in different countries, different markets, based on things that will be unique to those regions. So I think we're all going to have to be pretty alert to those changes and assess markets, not based on what we think might happen, but based on as much objective data as we can that says, here's how people are actually behaving.
Thank you very much, Mike, for taking the time to talk with us. This has been very insightful. I'm Dan Juergen, and we've been talking with Mike Wirth, the chairman and CEO of Chevron, about pandemics and the lessons from previous pandemics and how that helped Chevron prepare for where the world is today, about how the company's adapted, how the market's changed, adjusting to the market, and also thinking about the future. So thank you for joining us on the CERAWeek conversation.